Welcome to the Been There, Got Out podcast. I'm Lisa, a state-certified domestic violence advocate and veteran of more than 8 years in the trenches of the legal system, the last five successfully representing myself.
And I'm Chris. I'm a certified high-conflict divorce coach. And between the two of us, we have all this knowledge and experience that we never wanted. But now we can put it to great use, providing expert guidance to people in high conflict divorce and custody situations, so you have the best chance in court and beyond.
Having the right support from people who get it is so critical to getting you and your children through it as unscathed as possible. And that's exactly what we do through our interviews with experts and other content right here on this podcast. So let's get to it.
It's Lisa from Been There, Got Out, and tonight's guest is Dr. Alina Boye. We're really anxious to have her on. She's a child psychologist, both she and, oh, there she is.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
Yes. What a relief. It's like long awaited. I mean, we talked about doing this interview months ago. We tried, and now you're here. Thank you, Dr. Boye, Alina, for coming on.
This always pays off. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. Good. Well, I mean, you specialize in working with children. So why don't you first introduce yourself, because you're the kind of person that we need to talk to. And there's been questions and issues. So introduce yourself.
Yes. My name is Dr. Alina Boye. I'm a psychologist. My specialty is mainly working with children. I've been working with children for the past, I would say, 18 years. I got my doctorate at St. John's University, and ever since 2014, yes, it's been quite a long time. But pretty much all my life, starting with before college, I have worked with children all the way from, I would say, preschool toddlers to 22 and college population as well. So I'm very excited to be here. If you're wondering where my accent is from, I'm originally from Romania, Europe. I'm from Transylvania, so I have some vampire blood flowing in my veins.
Oh, I've been to Transylvania.
No full moon tonight, so no worries for everyone who's watching. But I'm very excited to be here tonight.
Well, thanks for coming. And again, you know, I've actually been to Transylvania because I used to live in Hungary. I've been to Sighetu Marmației, if you've ever heard of that.
Nice. Of course. It's a very special place.
Yeah. And it's actually one of the most beautiful countries I've ever been to in my life. But that's a whole other conversation.
Yes, it's a beautiful place for sure. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm so glad that you have such a wide range of experience with kids of all different ages, because our community and our clients have kids of all ages, but the thing that they have in common is they are usually going through a very difficult transition. And of course, their kids are as well. And one of the top concerns for me when I was going through my separation and divorce and post-judgment was, how are my kids going to be okay? That's top concern for protective parents, women and men. Like, what do I do? And I know when you and I talked about doing this interview, you said, I'm going to bring in some tips that people can do right now.
Absolutely.
Which is great because we're so crisis driven. So help now. What can people do?
I just want to start by saying that oftentimes adults tend to underestimate the children's resilience. Sometimes you find children being more resilient than adults are because they don't have the bias schemas of experience that the adults have had it so far, meaning that, you know, through our life, we acquire experiences that form and shape those cognitions, those schemas that we call them, that sometimes are our biggest enemy. I will give you an example. For instance, you know, certain people can be trusted. Like, you cannot trust people who are lying in your face, right? So if you have that deep schema that every person who ever lies is not to be trusted, which is a very extreme thing, right? Because everyone has lied at least once in their life, but that, for that matter, they could be trustworthy. You can just judge a person based on one or two instances, right? And so you have that deep belief, then you're going to filter the reality of the world we live in through those schemas and filters. It's like having those glasses on, you know, you have pink glasses on, you're going to filter the reality in pink shades. You have gray glasses on, and that's how your reality changes. So the reality we live is actually how we perceive it, not necessarily the real, you know, the real reality, if you want. Children are not so biased, because they don't have as much experience in life. So they sometimes can be more objective. And by doing that, they build this resilience. So I want to start saying, that's why I want to start a conversation by saying, you know, we as parents may make choices that are poor choices at times. That doesn't mean your child will be forever damaged. Don't be as a parent afraid to say, hey, I'm sorry, I messed up. I just messed up. I'm a human being too. Children view adults as someone who, you know, are sitting on those high podiums that you can't reach. They look at them as someone being perfect. And, you know, in my work with children, I keep reminding them there's nothing, nobody's perfect, right? So it's very important that, you know, we remind ourselves that our children see us as our biggest model. We are the biggest model for our children. And they learn by looking at what we do, not what we say. So if you keep on preaching that, you know, you shouldn't be like judging people, you shouldn't be, you know, hiding things from people, but you, in fact, do that as a parent, what's going to be perceived is what you do, not what you say, unfortunately. So I think it starts with parents being more mindful of their own actions, using themselves as models. Saying that, you know, I'm frustrated today, but it's okay. It's okay to be frustrated at times. It's okay to be angry at times. It's not okay to take actions when you're angry. So, but it's okay to be angry. You have the right to be angry. You have the right to be, you know, upset, overwhelmed, and so forth. So it starts by building their capacity of, you know, future great citizens by allowing them to take their parents as their model and coaching them. The problem is sometimes one parent, like in a divorce situation or when it's parent separation, some parents are better models than other parents. And I think that's when it becomes the problem if you're the parent who needs to compensate for the absence of another parent.
Or you're speaking the language of the people watching
if you
now
are
and
in a situation where the other parent is not doing a good job being a good model, because, you know, children learn both good and bad models. They take it as a sponge, right? Then you're in a situation where you have to compensate and also like coach your child to punish the behavior, not the person, you know, number one. And I think it's hard, even with adults, to catch yourself instead of saying, that's, you know, this person is so bad. They've messed up, you know, calling people names, things like that. You're labeling people, right? But if we teach our children to say, hey, you know, they've made a poor choice, we're judging the behavior, not the person, then you're serving two purposes. First, you're teaching them to stay away from labels because they're very absolute in nature, right? If you say, oh, he's such an idiot, you can't take that back. Like, what does that mean? You're just throwing words, right? Versus he acted in a very silly way. Like that was a poor choice on his hands. But the other thing you're teaching is that if they mess up, they don't put a label on their face, on their whole being, right? So if I mess up and I made a poor choice, I'm not a bad person, because we're all having positives and negatives. We're not all good or all bad. We have positives and negatives, and seeing the behavior, teaching your child how to label the behavior rather than the person.
Yeah, so that's making me think about how do you deal with it? Let's say I'm going to give an example of something we've seen. There's a divorce has happened. And one parent is taking a very young child and showing them a wedding album and saying, you know, your other parent is responsible for us not being together in this beautiful family. It's your other parent's fault. And then the child comes back to you and says, why would my parents say such a thing? How would you deal with something like that?
I think it depends on the age of the child. That's very important because our language.
Let's say like three, like a really young, like pre-K kindergarten.
What, you can start talking with a three-year-old is that, you know, or any relationship is an exchange, is a two-way road. So you're explaining in a child's language that you see, when you play with a friend, when you do anything with a friend, you share your toys, I share my toys. That's the relationship. Like, they already have some experience at the age of three, what it means to play with someone, to have a friend, to, it's not only take or give, right? It's an exchange, right? So what you do is you are focusing, you know, that child on the fact that in any relationship, mommy and daddy too, it's a two-way road. We give some, you take some, and the outcome is the, you know, what comes out of it is this combination of the two-way road. It's not only one person's fault. It takes two people to have a relationship. So you're trying to remove them from being biased by the other parent, saying that, you know, sometimes people say things when they're upset, that in fact, the relationship is something that, you know, just in any, as in any relationship, being that it's a two-way road, you're actually, you can't be the only one held accountable by, you know, the fact that this didn't work out. The truth is, it doesn't work out for various combinations of reasons. Sometimes kids react well when you read them stories. So I would say find a story about divorce or a story about the, you know, there's great children's stories that talk about relationships in general, and discuss it through it and see. The other thing is like, how does it feel when you are being blamed for something? We don't blame people. We're not shaming people, right? But then again, if you're the one who's blaming your child or blaming, you have two children and you say, it's your fault that your brother is crying. It is, you're always nagging your brother. See how, even if you talk about it outside of the context of a divorce, but you are using the blaming, shaming, paining, which are the three concepts that you want to stay away with when you parent a child. You don't want to shame them, blame them, and create pain, emotional pain, physical pain, pain in general. So if you're blaming others, then it's going to be very hard for you to like explain to a three-year-old why you're being blamed and how that's not nice.
Yeah. I mean, I like how you're relating it to a child's own experience. So instead of trying to explain or justify whatever happened in the divorce, like your own relationship, you just put that aside and you just connect it to their own experience, even a three-year-old with a friend, because they know what it feels like to not share or to get in an argument and things like that. So that's really helpful.
It usually you know, it's good to try to remove yourself from the situation that causes you emotional pain. If you're a parent in pain and you're trying to explain to your own child the pain you're going through, you're going to be very emotional. And you're not going to use your rational side of the brain that will be talking at that point in time. It's going to be your emotional side of the brain. So at that point in time, your emotions will be speaking. And one of the things we recommend parents to do is teach kids about their sides of the brain. Even a three-year-old, I have to tell you, in my experience, we've explained to the three-year-olds, we do this model of the brain. You hold your hand up, you put your thumb in, and you make a little brain from your hand, right? So it looks like your brain, and they point where their brain is. Like you can even do it as a silly activity. I say, is this your brain? Is this your brain? No, well, this is your brain. And then you teach them this part, which is this part right here. That's your thinking part of your brain. That helps you think, that helps you make decisions, helps you pay attention, helps you learn. And then this part inside your brain is that safe part of your brain. Now, the part of your brain that keeps you safe, meaning that the environment you're in is safe, that you have all that you need to survive, all your basic needs like water, food, air, you know, shelter, comfort, sleep. And then the third part of your safe brain is your emotions. Well, the way it works is when we're very upset. So usually, you know, we work at our thinking brain level, right? We think, we make decisions, we communicate, we actually memorize things. But when things get very emotional, or maybe when you're hungry or tired or hangry, you know, we call it. At that point in time, what happens is your thinking part of your brain flips, which means your safe brain takes control over your brain. There is only one part of the brain that can be connected at any point, that can be in charge, either your thinking part of your brain or your safe part of your brain. When you're in that safe brain level, that's your emotional level, you're in a fight, flight, freeze situation. So oftentimes we tell the kids, okay, here's your brain. We're talking about the brain, what part of the brain is in charge? And they say, oh, my thinking brain, because I'm thinking about the brain and learning. So what if through the door a lion was walking in? What happens? Your safe brain, who's the security guard, presses the panic button, at which point your thinking brain gets disconnected. Your safe brain takes charge, and you're either fighting the lion, flying away from your lion, running, or freezing. Well, there's no lion, obviously, but connecting it to our real world, when you're upset, mad, angry, that side of your brain, that's the thinking part of your brain, gets disconnected. So then you're either fighting, flying away, or freezing, right? So then we say things that we don't really mean, right? We don't use our rational side of the brain. That's when we react instead of respond. We react out of anger and rage. We're not having our side of the brain that would say, hey, stop, that's not a good choice. That's not what you mean. That's when we hurt people, right? So having these proactive discussions and teaching kids about those parts, like using their life experience and saying, you know, when you took the toy and threw it across the room, who was in charge in your brain? Well, my safe brain. And were you thinking about consequences? Not really. So how do you connect to your thinking brain? And then we teach them coping strategies, how to breathe, how to, you know, talk about your feelings, how to take a break, how to, you know, take a walk, let's listen to music. So building this rich toolbox proactively helps you a lot when you're in a situation like a divorce, an argument. The parents are like in an argument, sometimes even in front of children, unfortunately. And so how do you equip them so they can handle the situation that can be very stressful?
Yeah, that's really helpful. Now, what if it were, I mean, we often talk about that same thing in this community about fight, fright, flight, or freeze, or fawn. Do you ever talk about fawn?
Fawning? Well, the research behind the brain actually suggests that there are four reactions that people don't really talk about, the fourth. So it's fight, flight, freeze, or faint. Some people in an extreme situation where there's so much overload on your limbic system, they faint. So if you, there's a very small percentage that will get to that overload. But I mean, look in movies, even our own experiences, when you're like in such a shock, you can get your brain is so overloaded that it automatically is like you unplug the system, right? You're in override. And so, you know, people don't really talk about the faint part, but it can happen.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's really amazing to think about doing proactive conversations with even preschoolers about how the brain works. So it's almost like, oh, this is familiar when it's happening. It's not just like I'm completely losing my mind. It's like, oh, I know how my mind works. This is how it's working. And then I can hopefully come back to it. And it also seems like it gives kids a certain amount of agency to understand that even though my body is reacting to something that threatening me, I can still figure out ways to calm myself down. Absolutely. And I'm not relying on other people to do that.
And this is not only for, again, a divorce-like situation or an argument between parents. Those are skills you want your child to be equipped for life. This is something they can use in any kind of instance. I think what we run into is sometimes we are not proactive enough. And so when a situation arises, then, you know, it's almost like you're trying to compensate, and it doesn't always work. So the metaphor, I like to use metaphors. So one of my my ways of explaining this is, think about the bike, right? If you don't know how to ride the bike, but then you have to run and escape from an emergency situation, trying to learn how to ride that bike in the moment will be terribly hard. You're not going to be successful. But what if you practice and practice and practice and learn in an emergency situation, you will know how to hop on the bike and take off, right? So the same is true with this. If you are building that rich toolbox, you are spending time, quality time, to equip them with what they need. They will make sure that in those situations where you need them to use those tools, they're going to have a rich toolbox to go to.
Yeah, I mean, it makes so much sense. You think about just emergency planning, mm-hmm. like fire drills or anything else, where it's like, this is going to happen. You might not be able to avoid it happening, but how do you handle it when it happens? So instead of just focusing on avoiding and doing everything you can to make it never occur, but let's figure out how we're going to manage it when it happens.
Absolutely. And you know what? Maybe let's hope they don't have to use it a lot, but the fact that they practice it under your care and coaching, maybe they get to be in a situation as adults to manage a conflict, very stressful situation in a conflict-like situation, they will still have access to those toolbox.
Like, yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's something that it's invaluable. There's no better gift to give your child, but to be preparing for life for those instances. Unfortunately, we see parents a lot that nowadays trying to shelter them, not tell them, don't talk about it. You're protecting your child. The truth is, life won't protect them.
Right.
Because you shelter them all you want. By the time they reach adulthood, life will give them a full plate of situations. And if they have not had the opportunity to exercise that resilience, they haven't had an opportunity to exercise and practice those tools, then it's going to be very, very hard. And sometimes you see young adults run into depression, anxiety, they're being overwhelmed. You know, you see them engaging in drug abuse and risky behaviors because they don't know how to cope. So they escape the situation. They get into very dependent relationships that end up being abusive. And even though they know they're abusive, they're still sitting in that relationship because they're seeking what they've had their whole entire life, which is a protection, you know, someone like doing things for them. And that's what you don't want for your child. You don't want them to be a dependent personality, that you want them to be independent, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely speaking my language. I think I told you I used to teach high school English. And I think about how important it is for parents to actually teach and discipline their children, to teach them what's okay and what's not okay, instead of just sheltering them and giving in to everything, because kids are not really equipped to run the show. And sometimes parents get so, they do compensate, especially in these situations where they feel a lot of guilt. They feel like the kids are in pain or you know, having a hard time somewhere else. They're like, I'll make it as nice as possible. But then kids like that, I remember in high school, tend to get very anxious because they don't know what's okay and what's not okay. And they think, oh, you don't like me if you're saying no to me. It's like, no, that's not it. It's just I'm trying to teach you what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. But I love, again, the proactive part of it, where you're explaining things ahead of time and sort of giving them guardrails onto how to behave or what to expect and how to handle it. Because when anybody doesn't have the opportunity to fail or to mess up, then how do they know if they can get back up again?
Absolutely. And there's a whole, you know, there's a lot of literature around it. A teacher wrote a book about failure. And one of the things that were interesting in that book was that, you know, we as parents are very afraid to allow our child to fail because their failure is a reflection, or we take it as a reflection of ourselves. So if my child fails, I am not a good parent. I'm not, you know, I'm not the perfect parent. I am not, my self-worth depends on that. But the truth is, the more your child fails and you're there to coach them, the more you give them the gift of handling the situation. Now, I'm not saying like, okay, now create opportunities, let your child fail all day long. That's not what I'm saying, but allow them to have the experiences that life are providing with your guidance and coaching. So then when they become adults, they already have those shaped coping mechanisms that they can access. Because otherwise, yeah, either they learn unhealthy coping mechanisms from other people. Wouldn't you want to be the one the person who's giving them that ability and teaching them, rather than taking the chance that they may or may not take it from someone else, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so we got a question. Yeah. This is what I was going to save for a little bit later, but one of the big issues in our community is one parent trying to turn the child against another parent. Do you have any experience with that?
So the other parent, if I'm understanding correctly, the other parent is actually using either facts or lies to pretty much get the person to be, the child to be against that parent, right?
Right.
What we call this is, we also see this, we call this triangulation. You're trying to triangulate, you know, there are two people and then the third one who's the child, and you're trying to get the person to triangulate to be on your side, right?
Right. Especially during these high conflict separations and divorces, because, you know, it's a lot of power and control involved. So loyalty is a big issue.
Correct. And I think it boils down to the two fundamental needs that we have and children have as well. And I think that could be helpful in this situation. There's a theory that says that, you know, human beings, children included, have two basic needs. One is the need of control and the need of attention. Attention and control are the two big needs that give us the sense of belonging and significance. We all want to belong to something. We all want to feel that we are part of something. We're part of a family, a community, a school, and so forth. We belong. If you don't feel like you belong, you're pretty much lonely, depressed, and your mental health is being, you know, in a very poor shape. The other thing is that you're significant. You matter, right? And so the idea is when you lack significance, when you lack attention and you lack control, you don't have that sense of belonging fulfilled. So the theory says that we are going, or children will want to fulfill. It's like walking with two buckets every single day. One says attention, one says control. And if those two buckets are not proactively filled, at that point in time, you're going to seek those needs. And at that point in time, you will do anything to get it. In other words, if I don't get attention proactively by my parents saying, hey, great job, awesome, and all that, then I'm going to smack my brother because you're going to yell at me. And guess what? Good attention, bad attention, still attention, I'm fulfilling that need. If you tell me what to do and tell me what to do and micromanage everything about me as a child, that you're depriving me of control. Guess what? I'm going to get into power struggles. I'm going to argue with you, and I'm going to use my power of control. Even a little, like 1-year-old, if you as a parent, you cannot make them eat their food, even if you want it, you can make them chew it, right? That's, they're playing their power right there. It's a control. So when you get in power struggles, that's when kids need control. But going back to the one parent who's turning the child against the other parent, if your child is on a solid ground, they don't need attention. They have a good bucket filled of attention. They have a good bucket filled of control. They are allowed to make choices. They're allowed to have a say and so forth. It's going to be harder for the other parent to manipulate the child. Why? It's because how are you going to do it? You're going to give them extra attention. You're going to show them that you are the nicer parent. You're going to be probably, you know, playing on that weak side of, you know, what bucket is rather empty. And so, number one, if your child is on a solid ground, they're going to like be a little less vulnerable in this situation. And the other thing is, don't be afraid to keep facts away from your child, even if they're a little child, okay? If the other parent starts to be throwing lies, have a conversation at the level they are about how these are not true facts. They're not, it's not the truth in reality. And then talk about how, you see, you have to make decisions, even as a child, I'm putting the truth in front of you and I'm talking about it. I'm considering you like an equal part in this conversation. Of course, some things you can explain at the, you know, depending on the level of the child. But what I'm saying is don't be afraid to show them and tell them the truth. So then they are prepared to say, hey, that's not true. Mom never did that. And I know that. How do I know that? Because here's the truth in this. Here's the proof in this. If you're going to shelter them and not say anything, then they're going to be very vulnerable to triangulate. And the other person can become very manipulative. But by letting them know, like sometimes parents, you know, get into arguments. Here's the truth. If there's a truth. You're going to be less likely in a situation where they can take advantage of it. It's always hard because kids are torn apart between parents.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking like with the truth, it's like one parent is saying this is the truth and the other parent is saying, no, this is the truth. And the child doesn't know. And I'm thinking in particular with teenagers where they just say, no, that person said it and I believe them over you. And I was going to say, do you have any advice for people where the kids have been cut off from one parent and they won't even listen to anything that they have to say? It's almost like they believe the lie. I mean, I'm asking if you're not sure, that's okay. It's just, this is a big issue in our community.
I have worked with kids where, you know, they do triangulate with one person versus the other. But usually that's the case where that parent gives them more attention than the other parent. They spend more quality time because why do you believe the other parent? You're going to believe the parent who shows you the care, attention, but not like, you know, I'm buying you clothes, you're in my house kind of thing. If you're the mom or the dad caring for this child and they're in your house, but they have visitation time with the other parent and the other parent, all they do is spend quality time. They have fun with you. They bond. They connect. At that point in time, yes, they're going to believe that the other parent more than they do, even if you are the one caring for that person. Why? Because if you don't spend the quality time and you don't build the rapport, that child is not going to like believe you as much as the other person is, because they do have that true heart in them. Like they want to be loved and cared for, but also have that attention from that parent. If that parent makes them feel like you matter, it's a rapport you're building. It's almost like you have someone who's a stranger who gives you money every month. They pay your rent and bills, but then you have your best friend who doesn't have the money to give you, but they're there for you. They're there to listen to you. They're there to do things with you. They're there to cry with you and laugh with you. Who are you going to believe? You're going to believe the person who gives you money, but they're like barely present in your life. You don't have the bond and connection, or you're going to believe your friend who spends time with you qualitatively, and you have quality bonding time with that person. And so you want your child not to have to triangulate with the other person or the other parent. Have a good solid relationship with them. Spend quality time. One of the tools we teach parents to do is we call it the glowing and growing together. Set your time for 10 minutes every day with your child to do an activity that they enjoy. Let them guide the activity. Let them be in a situation where they're taking the lead and you are in your child ego, we call it, where you have fun with them and you laugh with them and there's no technology around you. There's no, like, your attention is undivided to this one particular child. If you have three children, take that 10 minutes with each one of your children if you can. It really is a magical, magical tool. Kids really start to bond differently. They trust you differently. They open up differently. You have another kind of like connection with them.
Yeah. You know, and that also fits with what you said about the two buckets of kids needing attention mm-hmm. and kids needing control. So by allowing them to have control over the activity and also letting them lead and you paying attention to them doing something that they want to do, you're fulfilling those two basic needs that you talked about, which makes sense.
And also I think when their parents are in conflict, keeping them as much as neutral as possible, you know, not, you know, allow yourself to, again, if you're judging your partner by their actions, not like putting a label on them, then you are a little bit more neutral to say, hey, your father, your mother made a poor choice. We are handling this as an adult. You are our child, and I know we are both meaningful for you because we are both your parents. And don't allow yourself to be sucked into like, I'm going to be against the other person, even if that person is against you. I mean, try to be as like using your thinking part of your brain rather than your safe part of your brain, your emotional side. I know that's terribly hard, but if you can remove yourself from the situation of showing that anger and labeling that person and being outraged by that person, and just telling your child, hey, you know what, we're handling this as parents. You don't have to choose between your parents, by the way, like in the sense of you're allowed to love both parents, even though they want can be making more poor choices than the other. You were born in this life with those two parents, and you are the result of those two parents, because sometimes they feel guilty. Like, you know, they see the poor choices the other parent makes and they feel like they should take the side of the other parent or the one that's taking care of them. And the truth is, it's not really fair to them too. Like, you're allowed to love both of your parents, even though one parent may be like the most, you know, outrageous person, human being on earth, but it's still your parent. You can't change them, right? But by not getting them to be turned against them, you're like, again, choosing to criticize the behavior, not the person.
Yeah. And, you know, before you alluded to something where you said sometimes parents are in pain and they're trying to talk to their children about their pain. That is also an issue. In this community where people are dealing with so much, it's not just the divorce or the post-judgment, it's a lot of stuff with court. So they're being traumatized all the time and they're having to parent at the same time. And it's very hard to separate those emotions because they're really, really stressed out and they're scared. Do you have any advice for those parents?
I think so. Starting with spending that 10 minutes, if you can remove yourself from that, I know it's hard and it's hard to remove yourself all day long, but if you can cherish those 10 minutes every day to glow and grow together, if you can put and pause those feelings for 10 minutes to play a board game, to draw a picture, to take a walk with your adolescent, if you make this a habit, even for you, it's going to be a good opportunity to just pause. You're pausing for 10 minutes, then you can really go back to it. So number one, like trying to cherish those moments and protect those moments for allowing your feelings and pain to penetrate and have the opportunity to bond with your child. The second one is, if you're in pain, talk about your pain. As much as you don't have to go into details and such, but sometimes it's some parents keep it to themselves, but their behavior speaks louder than words. Like, you're frustrated, you're grumpy, you're snapping at children, but they see all that. But what they don't know is what's going on. What is the puzzle? So don't be afraid to say, hey, I am very down today, and you know, it's been very hard. There was a court date and things were really unfairly said, and I'm sad and I'm upset, but you know what, I'm going to look at my toolbox and see what can I use in my toolbox. What do you suggest that I use? What do you use when you're feeling down? Because today I feel down a bit. And you know what? I could use some advice from you. Now you're giving them a chance to coach you. But you're also showing that you're a human being, that you have ups and downs, and that is okay. It's not, we're not perfect. We're not trying to be like, nothing's wrong. But then you, of course, with your behavior, show that a lot of things are wrong and you're not in a good place. And it's so heartwarming when you see them trying to problem solve with you and say, hey, mommy, you know what? I think you could just put your PJs on and go and watch your favorite movie because I know that makes you happy. How about that as a strategy? Now you're
That's
bonding.
Also teaching empathy,
yes,
but without pulling them into the details of all the mess. It sounds like you're focused not on the actual situation, but the feeling of like, I'm frustrated. What do you do when you're frustrated? To help me figure out ways to deal with my frustration, not fix the actual problem.
Correct.
That maybe nobody can fix.
Yes. And I think
it's, again, giving them that control and attention.
Of course, because now they're important, they're contributing. They're even a three-year-old, you know, you'll see a 2-3-year-old knowing like mommy's upset, and they go and bring you a little blanket to cover you because they know that when they're cuddled, they feel good. And that is when you see, wow, you know, all that teaching that I've done, look, it's producing a results, because now they know how to care for someone who's upset. And that also teaches them that, you know what? Sometimes you have to ask for help when you're upset. And mommy and dad or daddy ask for help, and that's okay. I should do the same when I'm there, right? Otherwise, you're teaching that we're going to bottle up our feelings. We're not going to talk about it. Everything's great. I'm not going to tell you because I'm sheltering you and you shouldn't have to put through this. But this is a teaching opportunity. It's a life lesson. You don't have to go into the details and make that other person look bad. But you can talk about, yes, your feelings that, yeah, you had a hard day. And that's okay. We are all human beings. And sometimes we have good days and sometimes we have bad days.
Yeah, that's such great advice. Okay, so let me ask, what about when you have like an older kid and they're showing at-risk behaviors or signs of at-risk behaviors, and one parent is saying, we really need to get this kid some help, but the other parent is saying, there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. That other parent is just trying to say that there's something wrong with you, and then the kid doesn't want to get help.
Well, when at-risk behaviors occur, number one, as a parent, you want to be equipped to notice how those at-risk behaviors may be packaged. Because sometimes kids may portray, their behavior may not necessarily at the first glance speak up that it's an at-risk behavior, when in fact it could be. So, for instance, you know, you have kids who are preferring to be in their room alone, being left alone, and that's what they're doing, is either they're ruminating on, like, you know, how life is not worth living for, and you know, you're thinking that they just need quiet time and a lot of quiet time. If you don't start to, like, you know, really pay attention, why do they need so much? Or maybe they're on chats and getting advice from strangers, which is a really big problem nowadays, because parents don't know as much as they think they do. They don't know how much kids are involved on games that have chats, that they talk to strangers around the world, they get advice from strangers. And some of those strangers, let me tell you, they're like really not in any position to give advice. In fact, they can put kids even in more danger. Okay. And so they have challenges, and kids can like get into situations where their at-risk behaviors are worsening instead of like being fixed. So I think the first step is identify risky behaviors, at-risk behaviors, know what to look for. One indicator would be sudden changes in your child's mood, sudden changes in their behavior. All of a sudden, they don't like to hang out in the living room as they did. They want to be in the room by themselves. That's a change in behavior. Why? Why are we doing? What's happening? You know, or they don't want to go and be outside anymore. They don't want to walk to school. They want to take the bus from, like, any sudden change, have to question it for many reasons. It can be bullying. It can be, you know, a situation that's been happening, a peer pressure. But suppose that you see those behaviors, going back to your questions, and that you believe in your heart that those need to be addressed. First thing you should do is contact the school. Kids play, like, they play, they learn at school. That's their, like, more than 90% of their day. If you think about it, during the school year, kids spend 7 hours at least in the school setting. Some of them even more if they have after school program, after school activities within the school, right? So they do spend more time there than with their own family. So contact the school, the mental health provider in the school, talk to them about it. That's your first stop. Regardless of what the other parent says, you don't have to have their permission to talk to the school psychologist, to the social worker, to an adult that they know in the school, because your child will be watched and they can do something to equip your child and talk to them about what's going on. The second thing is, you know, if you have custody, both parents have custody, they share custody and such, you can try to help your child, getting them help without that person, even if they're not agreeing to it, right? it's your child as well as their child, but you can and have the right to go ahead and ask for help, reach out. There's so many like agencies, organizations that are helping children. But I would start with the school first. If you have the proof that this is happening and the other parent is actually absolutely against it, DCF can be involved as well. So don't be afraid mm-hmm. to be the parent calling Child Protective Services and say, I need help here. Why? I share custody with my wife or husband and my child is presenting with at-risk behaviors. They're interfering with his well-being or her well-being of getting services. And they will intervene because this is neglect and it can be looked at in so many ways as, you know, educational well-being neglect and so forth. And they can intervene as well. But absolutely ask and do anything in your power to get help to help your child, because those risky behaviors can be the first stop before they attempt suicide, before they, and that can be fatal. So your partner disagreeing with it should not stay in the way of like getting help for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. That's helpful. I have a couple of people that I'm going to make sure they see this, this interview. Okay, I'm trying to think, like, is there any other, there's so many things we could keep talking about, but I don't want to take up your whole night. Any other things that we might have missed? And I know that you're not taking clients because you're super busy and you're teaching and you have your job, but any other tips that you want to leave people with?
I think we covered most of the tools. I would say one thing I want to leave people with is start thinking, and it's never too late, on how to make kids and help them become as responsible and as independent as they can possibly be. Because even in the context of divorce or a messy relationship, but even outside of that, the more independent your child is, the more control they have over, you know, what their actions are, the more prepared they will be for anything that life brings them. In other words, parents sometimes they do so much for their children. Like if your child is 5 years old, they've never done laundry, start teaching them how to do laundry. Give them the responsibility of packing, unpacking their snacks. Give them the give them the jobs and responsibilities. By the way, we want to stay away from the idea of chores. I hear parents all the time, oh, chores. Even the word chore sounds so negative. Mm-hmm. So teach your kids about being responsible and participating. Like you are belonging to this family. And all of us in our family, we have jobs and responsibilities. So find jobs and responsibilities. Even little one-year-olds can have a job and responsibility. That's turning off the lights when you leave the room. You lift them up and they turn them off. And you praise them as what a great job they've done. But they contribute. You see what I say? So it's like start very early to give responsibilities to your children. Praise them for doing that. Coach them to get them as independent as they can be. And I tell parents, think about if today was your last day, and I know it's kind of, you know, it can make people like tremble just at the thought, but if today was your last day on earth, if you were to not be alive anymore, looking back, are your children as independent as you could have made them be? And if the answer is no, not really, work on it and work very hard to get them as, you know, independent as they can possibly be, because that's when they're going to be empowered and that's going to be making them not only resilient but being able to speak up, and you're not going to then need to be the person who's like pointing out things to them, because they will be able to see things through their own eyes. But it starts from making them responsible, giving them the trust, the control, the independence. So then they grow into the adults you want them to become.
Yeah, that's excellent. And it, you know, everything you've described makes me think that's what helps anyone develop confidence. Right. And that also fits in with what you said, that everyone's human nature is to want to have a sense of belonging by giving kids responsibilities and making them like, you're an integral part of this family. We need you. You have these roles and we're a unit together. Yeah, but excellent. Well, thank you so much, Alina, for coming. And I'm so glad this worked out.
You're very welcome. I'm happy that we were able to work this out, and I'm happy that I was able to come. And I hope, you know, everybody who joined was able to like take something away from what we've discussed and use it in their journey.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, take care and enjoy the rest of the summer.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Been There, Got Out podcast. Please leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening on. And you can find us easily on all major social media, but especially Instagram and YouTube. If you think we might be able to help you with your own situation, just visit beentheregotout.com and click the button to schedule a complimentary discovery call. Thanks again, and see you next time.